Good afternoon and welcome to your own health and fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman and I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and integrated health. It can have a genetic predisposition, but prevention and treatment can be achieved through lifestyle adjustments alone. Even so, type 2 diabetes is at epidemic proportions in this country, a disease of accelerated aging. It attacks the body's energy-making pathways, gums up all tissues, severely curtails circulation, and damages the heart to the point where lack of circulating blood and nutrients results in losses of both eyesight and eventually even the extremities and limbs. Although it's a disease of accelerated aging, its incidence in the young is rising dramatically. Why wouldn't someone be willing to lose weight by changing their diet and increasing their exercise to avoid type 2 diabetes? Today we'll explore some of the causes and cures. Today's show is Type 2 Diabetes, a Non-Pharmaceutical Approach, this hour. It's a solo show. Well, you know, to begin with, I want to say that I don't want to misrepresent myself here. I'm not blaming the victim when I'm talking about diabetes. In other words, I'm not just saying, like a lot of people, as a result of reading epidemiological research, you know, epidemiology, will say, you know, if people would just avoid this and this and change their lifestyles, they wouldn't get sick. It's complicated here because there are socio-political reasons for, I think, this epidemic that we're experiencing in this country. I don't feel like I'm an expert on this aspect of the disease, and I will probably do a show soon on that whole issue. But let me say this about it, which is that we are seeing a very high incidence of diabetes among people in the low-income bracket and people of color. And there are several reasons for this. I mean, one is, generally speaking, there may be a lack of information. And the lack of information is across class. That has more to do with stuff that we talk about frequently, or I talk about frequently on the show, and I think my guests do too, which is that which research projects are getting out to the general public, what pieces of information are available and out, and what information which is just as scientific that are conclusions that are drawn from equally scientific studies and that are in the files, so to speak, of medical research, are not discussed, they're not printed. They may have appeared in a journal at some point, but the information is suppressed and not discussed. The reason is because, you know, like everything, you sort of have to follow the money. And it isn't as simple as just that the pharmaceutical companies pay for research. Some of it has to do with the fact that there has been a long movement in this country toward the food pyramid, which stresses grains at the top of the pyramid, a high carbohydrate, low fat diet. And it's taking a very long time for us to do a full circle and come back to research which has been around really since the 40s, that shows that, in fact, people do better on a protein-rich, relatively high-fat, very low-carbohydrate diet. In fact, type 2 diabetes, which is what I'm really talking about today, rather than type 1, which is more of a potentially autoimmune problem where the body is destroying the beta cells, which make insulin. So these are people who are naturally low in insulin. Type 2 diabetics is, like I said, although there's a predisposition in families, a very strong predisposition, and there may be environmental links, you know, from pollutant and exposure to certain kind of toxins that may make this condition worse. But truthfully, this is a situation that can be prevented through diet and lifestyle changes and exercise and whatnot. So why are we being told that we should be eating this other diet? Well, as I was about to say, early treatment of type 2 diabetics, maybe as far back as 40 years ago, they did use a high-protein, high-fat diet because you can't convert fat into blood sugars, and it's blood sugar you're trying to control here. Protein in meat is very slow to be made into blood sugar. So these are foods that diabetics can eat fairly comfortably without impacting on their blood sugar levels. why then has there been this reversal? Well, there, as I said, has been a real campaign in this country, and I don't feel that I'm an expert in this area. I am going to put some experts on about this, but I think what you can say about it is that there has been a strong push to promote products in this country that are produced by the country, by that we are producing ourselves, which are high carbohydrate foods and damaged oils and low cholesterol. And then obviously there is a pharmaceutical link here, because if you can control diabetes with diet and exercise, why would you need all these very effective and very complicated and new all the time diabetes drugs? In addition, you have diabetes. People with diabetes suffer from hypertension and usually from heart disease and circulatory problems. So they are also candidates for all kinds of other medications, and in fact are often put on them. They are taking hypertension medicines. They're taking things to lower their lipids, their cholesterol. Some of them are on antidepressants because of the effects of the disease is depressive. Some of them may even be taking some kind of weight loss things and diuretics to lose fluid, which again feeds the dysfunction of the cells and of the pathways that are affected by this disease. Now, what I do want to say about the class issue here is that anybody who drives around and drives to different parts of urban landscapes will note that when you move into a lower income or a neighborhood, or a neighborhood of people where there are highly populated by people of color, which is of course getting harder and harder to do in urban landscapes because they're being forced out economically, what you will notice is that the neighborhoods do not have grocery stores. They have fast food stores, little 7-Eleven and gas convenience stores. And they have lots of liquor stores, but there's no Safeway, relatively speaking. There's hardly any supermarkets. What this means is that access to foods that would promote a diet that would not cause diabetes is hard. There's difficult access for people. The food that's accessible to people in lower income areas, urban areas, is fast food, which has an enormous amount of carbohydrates in it. You may think, oh, but you know, these are hamburgers, but they're barely hamburgers. I mean, they're wrapped in increasingly exotic forms of hyper refined starch that sometimes doesn't even have real wheat or material in it to begin with. It's so chemical in nature, and then fried in oils that are highly damaged and very toxic. The meat that they use is full of hormones and chemicals. The sugar content of the sodas and the drinks and even the main dishes in fast food are so astronomical. I mean, there's now sugar in everything. If you look in your table salt, you'll notice there's dextrose in it. It's everywhere. And in fast food, it's astronomical. This is not a protein meal that you're eating at a fast food restaurant. In addition, liquor stores, I mean, what are you going to buy in liquor store? You're going to buy corn chips or something, if you're lucky enough to even find corn chips. It's all going to be fast food that is cooked with hydrogenated fats and all kinds of things that damage your metabolism. So it is, in fact, in even a higher curve among lower income and people of color. So this is I mean, it's a very strong thing to say, but it's a form of genocide, in my opinion. So we have a real crisis on our hands. It's affecting everybody. Please don't get me wrong. I see an enormous number of diabetics in my practice who are where the class issue is not an issue, and they have access to good quality foods. But obviously, organic meats are more expensive than the food that you buy in a supermarket. The ones that are not raised by industrial farming are at least a pound or more, a dollar or more a pound than the foods that are accessible in large grocery stores, if you even have a grocery store in your neighborhood. And yet people who have access to organic food and lots of good quality food and can control for, you know, have even health food stores in their neighborhoods and stuff like this, are still victims of this disease. And as far as not blaming the victim, it might be very interesting to note that, as I've mentioned, the information that is available to people, and that's even people who read over and over and over again has been stressing high carbohydrate. And when someone begins to become diabetic, their doctors sometimes, often, a few doctors now, courageously or not, but are telling them to eat a high carbohydrate meal. This said, I have heard from people that some doctors know that they should be eating a diet where they're controlling not only refined carbohydrates, but all carbohydrates. That said, I think even the Diabetes Association says that a little bit of sugar is okay. Now, this is very odd if you're trying to control blood sugar, huh? Doesn't that seem a little odd? What is going on? Well, maybe instead of getting carried away with food policy, what I might do is just give you some information. Again, I will pick up the issue of the sociopolitical implications of this diabetes epidemic in future shows, but please remember to be cynical about the studies that you're reading. This includes, incidentally, this new HRT study that just came out that everybody's frightened about, and I have a show scheduled about that. But I think you can intune that my concern here is you have to look at what kind of materials were used in the studies. You have to understand that they didn't control for people's diets or hormone levels. They just gave hormones to women without checking their hormone levels. You know, there are a lot of problems with these studies, and what kind of hormones were they using? They were most likely, certainly the progesterone was not natural progesterone. We know that's carcinogenic. So on to diabetes again. Type 2 diabetes, as distinct from type 1 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is a situation that can occur very early in childhood. It does run in families. It's a situation where the beta cells in the pancreas are not making insulin at all. So the blood sugar is high because there's no insulin around to lower it. This is often thought to be an autoimmune problem where the body is attacking the beta cells and destroying them. But there are many other reasons why this may be happening, and there are many theories. There are theories about infectious agents, milk allergy, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. But we're going to focus on type 2 today because it's much easier to treat and to prevent. I'm using, for a lot of my information, I have gone back to a source, which is Richard Bernstein, MD, who has written two books on diabetes. One is called The Diabetes Solution, and he also has an older book called Diabetes Type 2. Dr. Bernstein is a bit eccentric. Whenever you read books by people like him, you have to take what's valuable in them and watch out for the other stuff. He just says that alcohol is okay for diabetics, which I disagree with. He says that artificial sweeteners are okay, and he doesn't advocate the use of vitamins. So I disagree with him on those issues, but he is one of the person who's done the most writing in a very scientific way about the mechanisms involved in diabetes. So it's a good education if you are diabetic or have it in your family and you want to understand how this works. But for now, I will try to give you some idea. We've been talking about the beta cells in the pancreas. The beta cells in the pancreas make insulin, and insulin is a hormone. It regulates the level of glucose in the blood by moving it into the cells. So it's not only a hormone for lowering blood sugar, that's a kind of side effect. Its actual primary cause, reason for existing, is to move glucose, which is energy, through the blood and into the cells so that you can utilize the energy, right? So it regulates the level of glucose in the blood by moving it into the cells. Then the cells will convert glucose and fat in the blood into fat for storage. Got it? Glucose. This is sugar. It's regulated, the levels are regulated by moving it into the cells. The cells convert the sugar into fat for storage. Now, insulin is necessary for the growth of tissues and organs. It's a growth factor. That means too much will cause excessive growth. So high insulin will increase body fat, particularly around the belly, and will increase the cells lining the vessels, which can increase hypertension and things like that. It's implicated as well in cancer, because cancer cells express more insulin receptors, which means they live on sugar, cancer cells. Insulin also regulates the balance of hormones. It has an effect on all your other hormones. It regulates sugar in the blood by regulating the liver and the muscles. It directs them to make and store glycogen. Glycogen is stored glucose. It's stored energy. And it is the energy that you use when you begin to exercise or you go outside and you do something vigorous, or even if you have a nice, vigorous sexual event or something, you know, anytime when you're active physically and excited, you're using stored energy, and you have roughly an hour and a half worth, depending on your fitness level, of stored energy. The alpha cells, we had the beta cells, these are the alpha cells, who are also in the pancreas, release another hormone called glucagon, G-L-U-C-A-G-O-N. Glucagon, and this occurs when the blood sugar is low. In other words, you've used up your stored glycogen, your blood sugar is getting low. Then glucagon signals the muscles and the liver to convert stored glycogen, I guess you still have some left, stored glycogen back into glucose, all right? So, when, in other words, what we're saying here is as you begin to exercise and you need the stored glycogen, it's released because of the release of glucagon, which gets that the blood sugar is going down and signals the muscles and liver to convert the glycogen that you have stored back into sugar, back into glucose. The blood sugar goes up, and when the body's stores of glucose and glycogen are exhausted, so at the end of an exercise session or a prolonged, either a prolonged aerobic session, where you start burning fat when you use aerobic exercise, but you start off burning sugar, or at the end of a weightlifting session, or if you're sprinting, or it's a long session of exercise, or whatever, or a hard day, your body uses up what's there, what's stored. The liver uses protein from muscles and vital organs to make sugar when this happens. So, glucagon is released when the blood sugar is low. It tells the muscles and the liver to convert the glycogen back into glucose. The blood sugar goes back up. And when the body uses up the glucose and glycogen, the liver uses protein from your muscles and vital organs to make sugar. So you want to be careful about getting to that point. Huh? Carbohydrates cause your blood sugar to go up. All carbohydrates, even refined and unrefined, in other words, even the coarse carbohydrates, are still going to cause your blood sugar to go up. When the blood sugar goes up, your insulin gets high. And when your insulin stays high for too long, it begins to cause something we call insulin resistance. This is where your tissues begin to become blunted to the message from the insulin hormone, because there's just too much of it around, and it just gets overwhelmed. It overwhelms the system. Then the sugar ends up being rejected by the cells because there's no insulin here. There's no signal. The cell goes back into the blood and gets converted into fat, which are called triglycerides. Overproduction of the beta cells. If you keep causing your insulin to go up and up and up, and you have constantly high levels of insulin, you're starting to get this thing of the tissues not responding because everything's getting worn out. Blood sugar goes into the blood, gets converted into triglycerides, which are blood fats, and fat in general. If you do this over and over and over again, essentially what's happening is you're overproducing insulin and you're wearing out the beta cells which make the insulin. So when this begins to happen, this is called hyperinsulinemia, just really high levels of insulin all the time. This can also cause high blood pressure, and it damages the circulatory system. Remember that insulin is a hormone, and it's irritating to the cell walls of the blood vessels. So this is a primary cause of high blood pressure, particularly in people with high blood sugars, which is what you see in people who overproduce insulin. I just want to let you know where you are. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm doing a solo show today about type 2 diabetes. I am trying to give you some kind of overview of the disease and discuss prevention and treatment in a non-pharmaceutical way with lifestyle and diet. Okay, so there's a cascade here. Remember I talk about the principle of cascades. This is the idea. This is what I believe health integration to mean. I know people use the term health integration in different ways. What I mean by health integration is that nothing that happens in the body happens in a vacuum. one thing happens and causes a ripple effect, and it affects everything else. It's dominoes going down. It's ripples in the water. From a physiologic, if you study physiology, they call these cascades. So the cascade that's working here in type 2 diabetes is this. Fat in the blood feeding the liver causes insulin resistance, which causes elevated insulin levels, which cause the fat cells to build even more abdominal fat, which raises the triglycerides in the liver, which causes insulin levels to rise because of increased resistance to insulin. So you've got a circle. You start out with somebody who's too fat. Forgive me for using that word. It's not very PC, but too much fat on the body. Too much fat in the body, the fat in the blood is feeding the liver. It causes insulin resistance, where the tissues are blunted to the insulin hormone. That causes the insulin levels to rise because you have to make more insulin to lower the blood sugar, and the blood sugar is toxic to the body, so it has to be lowered. So the insulin levels rise much higher than they would in an individual who's not insulin resistant. And this causes the fat cells to make even more fat around the belly. And that raises the triglycerides in the liver even higher. And that causes the insulin levels to rise because of the increased resistance to insulin. It's a complete circle. Now, the fat we're talking about is not dietary fat. It's triglycerides. They're in the blood from carbohydrate consumption and existing body fat. But triglycerides are just fat. I mean, when you eat animal fat, it's triglycerides. Fat, triglycerides are fat. But they can be measured in the blood, and that's one of your markers for diabetes, is how high your triglycerides are. Primarily, when you're talking about someone with insulin resistance, what you expect to see is a lot of weight gain in the belly. And this is across gender. You'll see men who look like they're in about their seventh or eighth month of pregnancy. Big bellies. We used to call them beer bellies, which might be true because beer is carbohydrates and alcohol is a sugar, and sugar is an alcohol. Weight gain in the belly, women who lose their waists and have these apple-shaped bodies. These are the people who get more heart disease, partly because, in fact, diabetes and heart disease are in the same compartment. So the belly fat is a signal that you're dealing with insulin resistance. Now, truthfully, some type 2 diabetes don't have a lot of belly fat. Some of them are thin. And this is because there are some type 2 diabetics who are incomplete type 1 diabetics, and they don't make much insulin. Now, I'm not sure that we know exactly what's happening in this situation. I think that one reason it can happen is that something has damaged the beta cells. Either it's autoimmune, that the beta cells have been attacked by the tissues. I also think there can be an environmental component, that something in the environment, some kind of infectious agent, can knock out the beta cells in childhood. So these are people who make some insulin but not enough. And they still end up, oddly enough, becoming insulin resistant. So you still have to get them to change their diets and exercise and get their tissues to start responding better, especially because they don't make enough. So you've got a real problem there. But they still, an incomplete type 1 diabetic that is a type 2 can still be treated like a type 2 diabetic. You don't have to go and get insulin shots. There are things you can do. And if you are a type 1 diabetic, some of the advice that I'm going to be giving out today will apply to you too, because if you follow the advice and you are using insulin, you can use much less insulin. And then since we know that insulin in excess is a growth factor and can cause problems not only with your sex hormones but with your circulatory system, and is a growth factor in terms of cancer, so you don't want to use more insulin than you need to. Now, there are things that people can, you know, I'm talking about a lifestyle disease. Again, I'm not blaming the victim, but what I'm saying is that truthfully, weight gain is one of the reasons for people becoming diabetic. It isn't the only reason. Like I said, there are people who are not really, really fat who get diabetes. and there are a variety of reasons I just mentioned for that. But weight gain in general is what we see most classically. In other words, I said at the beginning of the show that this is a disease of accelerated aging. And we are used to seeing it in people as they age, as they become middle age or older. But the incidence of type 2 diabetes in the very young is rising. And the reason it's rising is because people are becoming obese early in their lives. Weight gain completely changes the hormonal balance. In men, the insulin contests their testosterone and lowers it, which means that their circulatory system is not protected anymore. It means that their lean body muscle-to-fat ratio changes and the estrogen levels go up. In women who have too much insulin around from eating too much carbohydrates and having high blood sugars all the time, what happens is that the follicles in your ovaries don't make progesterone, which causes the egg to mature the way it's supposed to. Instead, what happens is the follicles end up making testosterone. And that testosterone converts into more estrogen. So you've got a lot of testosterone, a lot of estrogen. The eggs don't mature. They become cysts on the ovaries, and you end up with polycystic ovary disease. So one of the things that's very provocative for diabetes in the young is going to be sudden weight gain beyond puberty, around puberty or just right after it, because the fat cells only can become full. The fat cells don't multiply. They get full, and then they reject the blood fats and the sugar and send them back into the blood. So your fat cells become full, and then they that kind of mechanism where they can't take up any more of the sugar can be a cause for getting diabetes. Now, I do see young people, young women, for instance, who have this syndrome of insulin resistance who are not overweight, but they tend to have acne. They tend to have very greasy hair. They may have a little extra hair growth, and they're usually not having periods or they're having terrible problems with their periods. So they're often put on birth control pills, which can be not such a good scene, partly because it actually lowers their testosterone, which sounds intuitively like it should be the right thing, but it adds in a synthetic progesterone instead of a natural progesterone. And these studies that you're seeing in the paper are saying that the synthetic progesterones, essentially what we're learning is that they are more carcinogenic. So it isn't solving the problem. The problem is that there's no progesterone around. It should be a natural progesterone, and the problem is also diet and exercise related again. Incidentally, also, we're talking about this syndrome occurring in both genders, and remember that it's this apple-shaped body that's frequently the real clue that you're dealing with insulin resistance, although, as I said, it can appear in individuals who are not obese. I need to take just a brief 20 to 30, 40-minute break here, musical break. I am Lena Berman, and I'm doing a solo show on Your Own Health and Fitness today about type 2 diabetes, non-pharmaceutical approaches to treatment and prevention. I'm going to take a musical break, and I'll be right back with you, so please stay with me. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. Clearly, that wasn't 30 to 40 minutes. That was seconds. Thank you, George. this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I'm doing a solo show today about type 2 diabetes prevention and treatment in a non-pharmaceutical approach. As I mentioned, some of the information that I'm using for this show is out of the writings of Dr. Richard Bernstein, B-E-R-N-S-T-E-I-N, M-D. He has two books. One is called Diabetes Type 2, and the other is called Dr. Bernstein's Diabetes Solution. I think it's listed starting with his Dr. Bernstein's Diabetes Solution, I think is the way you find it. And you can find it on the web. And most bookstores will be able to order it for you if you'd like it. Just a word of warning is that he is... you may be surprised by his recommendations about alcohol and artificial sweeteners. My own experience is that alcohol raises blood sugars in type 2 diabetics and in the long run also is just not good for the liver. He mentions that it paralyzes the liver, and that's why some people don't get high blood sugar from drinking, but long-term effect of drinking is toxic to the liver. Even smaller amounts are. It raises estrogen in men, testosterone in women. It makes the problem worse. But most importantly, what I see in my own practice is that it raises blood sugars. Artificial sweeteners, in my experience, raise blood sugars markedly in diabetics and everybody else, too. And it's also they also have a lot of toxic brain things that are toxic to the brain in them, like NutraSweet has very toxic stuff in it. It is possible to use stevia, S-T-E-V-I-A. That is the only artificial sweetener that I'm sure is not impactful to blood sugars. There is some literature out about xylitol now that looks promising. I don't know anything about Splendra. I'm suspicious. But for now, stevia, I know, is okay. Incidentally, if you miss any parts of today's show and you want to get a cassette copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can always call my information number to get information or to, you know, comments or if you need information about me. It's 707-874-2772. It's 24 hours. 707-874-2772. Or the website, which is yourownhealthandfitness.com. Let's talk a bit about blood sugar in general. Blood sugars... You know, when you talk about normal, when you talk about normal ranges, it's always very difficult. It's difficult for so many different reasons. The main reason, though, is that normal people are anomalous. In other words, it's a rare normal person. They mostly don't exist. So whenever anyone talks about normal levels, it's a pretty broad range, and there's going to be variations, and you always want to look at the person and how they're doing, what their symptoms are. Instead of relying on normal levels, but what people who care about these things care about is that blood sugars stay somewhere between 80 and 100, roughly. Now they can go down lower than that without people feeling badly, and some people can have their blood sugar slightly higher. The thing to remember here is that high blood sugar is extremely damaging to the body. It's just so bad. It causes the increase of a substance called AGE, and I don't remember the breakdown of the various scientific words that goes into it, but this stuff deposits a sticky substance all over the body. It gums up everything. It's one of the causes for the effect of it causing early aging, accelerated aging. Diabetes really mucks up your circulatory system. We see an association between high blood sugars and Alzheimer's disease. You'll see families with diabetes and Alzheimer's together, and always heart disease as well. Having high blood sugars for prolonged periods of time is very toxic to the body. So it isn't true that you want to just let it go and not worry about it. You know, some people cruise along taking diabetic medications with their blood sugars in the 130 levels. Well, it may be the case that if you're treating diabetes non-pharmaceutically, that in the first year or two, your blood sugars may be even as high as 160, but you don't really want that to happen. What you prefer to see is that the blood sugars stay down around 100. They might be slightly, 110, but you really want to get them down. And what I'm saying is that depending on how long someone's been a diabetic, if you're dealing with someone who's been a diabetic for 30 years and you're doing a non-pharmaceutical approach, it may take a couple of years before the blood sugars go to normal. On the other hand, if you're treating it pharmaceutically and somebody is just walking around with 130 blood sugar with medication, that's not a good scene because that's going on and on and on, and it's not trending down. And even 130 can be damaging, very damaging to the heart. So for non-diabetics, you're looking at 80 to 100. That's kind of your target range. And what happens in people who don't have diabetes, where the, essentially what we're talking about, if you've been listening carefully, is a disease that affects the way the body makes energy. It's the pathways of energy production using glucose. And glucose is manufactured by the body, can use fat, can use protein to make glucose if it has to. No, not fat, I take it back. It won't use fat. It will use protein to make glucose. It is a slower process, and it's one of the reasons why blood sugar doesn't rise. You need some glucose to for your brain to work, but your body will make it from protein, from meat, and I said more slowly, which is why it controls blood sugars, to eat a high-protein diet with less carbohydrates. All carbohydrates will make a lot of sugar, even broccoli. You know, all of it will. And vegetables are carbohydrates and usually have quite a bit more than you'd ever imagine. Fruit is a simple sugar, has to be watched, and certainly starchy carbohydrates like all your fun foods, all the breads and pastas and rice and even the whole grains are all going to be provocative, and potatoes and stuff. But we're talking about a disease that affects the energy pathways. Then it then also is going to be affecting circulation and everything else. So we're talking about a range of 80 to 100. Non-diabetics maintain their blood sugars with less highs and lows, less dips and valleys. As soon as you're dealing with someone with insulin resistance, a type 2 diabetic will make 2 to 3 times more insulin in the same meal in a non-diabetic compared to a diabetic. Diabetic with insulin resistance will make 2 to 3 times more insulin until the pancreas is so burnt out that the blood sugars are only lowered very slowly. And then the body is exposed for prolonged periods of time to these high blood sugars. As we said before, the high insulin stimulates, well, we didn't say this before, I'll say it now. The high insulin also stimulates a hunger response in the brain, partly because it does lower blood sugar eventually, which makes you hungry. But it also, a lot of insulin will make people very hungry. And it produces this hunger response in the brain, and it also stores more of the blood sugar that you're making from food as fat. So it causes this vicious cycle of hunger for sweets and starches, high blood sugars, high insulin levels, more cravings, more weight gain, more insulin, more blood, until you're ending, you're then you're stuck with this kind of situation of blood sugars not going down at all. Anyway, in a diabetic, what you expect to see is the blood sugar, 2 hours after eating, is still high. 2 hours is still high. So there are a variety of tests to check to see if you're on your way to becoming a diabetic. The old days, they did something called a glucose tolerance test. It's funny that they say that the word tolerance is in there because it's an intolerable test. I actually remember having one of these when I was about 11, and even 11, I got so sick from it because they have you drink this totally artificial chemical soup sugar thing, and then they check your blood sugars. They do these blood draws. I think I passed out finally when I was 11 from all the blood draws. So it's a very, very difficult test, and for someone who is diabetic, it's very provocative, and it makes them feel really sick. I remember one diabetic saying that he felt, when his blood sugars got really high, as if he had syrup running through his veins, which is true. So glucose tolerance tests, I think, are still used by some people. Probably the benefit is that you get to see the body's response and curve over a long period of time, but I generally don't recommend it to my clients because it's so stressful. Well, another way that doctors are typically checking to see if someone is in the direction of a diabetic is to order a hemoglobin H1C, test. What this does is it provides an estimate of your average blood sugars over a period of time. Now, the drawback to this test is that if your upper and lower ranges in the values of the lab, if they're upper and lower ranges of what's considered normal by this particular laboratory are too wide, then it's not going to give you a very good reading, it's going to be deceptive. And if your own blood sugars vary widely, the average, which is what they're measuring, may not be representative. You may look like you're within the normal range. You may have a hemoglobin H1C of 6, which is at the upper limits of what's normal. But in fact, if you checked your blood sugars during the day, you'd find that sometimes your blood sugar is inappropriately high, and that's still not good. So this test is not a perfect way of checking it. But if you're headed towards 6 or above, you know you're kind of in a situation you have to watch. Another way to tell is that it's pretty common for people to get a lipid panel. And on a lipid panel where you're checking cholesterol and whatnot, you want to watch for a high triglyceride reading. And what's a little difficult here is that most laboratories will tell you that a level of triglycerides from something, you know, upwards of 2 to 400, you know, is still considered okay. It's not okay. Anything above 100 is beginning to be suspicious. So even if your lab says 200 is still normal, you should be worried if it's above 100. It really shouldn't be. You should really have triglyceride levels of like 70 or something. So if your triglycerides are inching their way up toward 100 or they're above 100, that's ominous. Typically, in a diabetic who's a full-blown diabetic, you'll see triglycerides of 400 to 600. That's really not a good scene. These are fat. This is fat gumming up your everything. And then, if you see a triglyceride slightly above 100, like 129, 149, and your LDL cholesterol is high, it's 160 or something, that's particularly ominous because that may be a very early warning sign that you're dealing with small particle LDL. And that's very common in diabetes. In fact, I really think that small particle LDL is, in fact, a sort of insulin-resistant diabetic trait. Although it can exist in somebody who's controlling their blood sugars, it certainly exists in family lines, but small particle LDL is that little tiny particles of LDL that break off and you form clots around them, and that's a ticket out of here, really. Very hard on it causes early heart attacks and whatnot, and it is very common in diabetics, so that's an early warning sign. High triglycerides over 100 and high LDL. It's worthwhile to then get an expanded cholesterol test, which we've discussed on other shows. You can always go to the website and look for the show on the Heartstopper gene to find out more about that test. Another test is to look for your thrombotic risk profile and look at clotting factors like homocysteine, which is a slight mistake in metabolism in susceptible individuals where in response to a certain amino acid, your body produces too much homocysteine, which can give you a lot of circulatory problems and heart attacks. It is controllable through diet and the addition of supplements like the B vitamins, B12, trimethylglycine, TMG. Did you say something, George? Folic acid was the big one. Folic acid's the big one. That's a B vitamin. You also want to check your amount of fibrinogen. It's F-I-B-R-I-N-O-G-E-N. Fibrinogen are these fiber-like fragments that cause clotting problems. And for the existence of a lipoprotein, lipoprotein A, it's capital L, capital P, small a, lipoprotein A. Those levels are high. That's a disturbing piece to the puzzle. You can check urinary protein to make sure that your kidneys are okay. If you're spilling protein, that's a bad scene and it can happen in diabetes. Another one is creatinine, C-R-E-A-T-I-N-I-N-E, creatinine clearance, which is a byproduct of muscle metabolism. So one of the things that happens with type 2 diabetics and type 1 is that the body will have these variations. There's a thing called the dawn phenomena where people who are diabetic will get up in the morning and their early morning blood sugars are really high. And you think, well, now, wait a minute, I haven't eaten anything for 12 hours. Why is my blood sugar high? Well, that's why your blood sugar's high, is that the body responds to a lack of blood sugar to lowering a blood sugar by having a kind of panic reaction, stress reaction, and it starts breaking down your muscle tissue. So diabetics have a really hard time maintaining muscle mass. They start breaking down their muscle mass. Type 1 diabetics are the ones that you see, you know, think Mary Tyler Moore. They're very thin. Their body is catabolic. That means it's breaking down tissue, and it's breaking down tissue and trying to make sugar out of it. It's a real bad scene. So you'd see a high creatinine clearance, muscle loss in that situation. And what we're also saying here is that diabetics are susceptible to stress as a result of this. High stress situations will cause them to become catabolic and cause their blood sugars to go up. Body gets a stress signal, it starts making blood sugars to get you out of there, you know, in a crisis. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. Lena Berman here, health integrationist, a solo show on a non-pharmaceutical approach to type 2 diabetes. Now, I might just make a quick comment here. Why don't I like medication? I think clearly one of the reasons is because in my experience, it really isn't that hard to control diabetes with diet and exercise. It's really extraordinary how well it works. It's amazing. And it isn't the case that when you take a medication that it's a completely free ride. There is always some kind of metabolic change when you take a pharmaceutical. You're also putting some pressure on your liver, although some of the new diabetic medications are not so impactful, but you're still artificially lowering something the body is trying to do for a reason. And if you remove the reason for it to do it, you're going to be a lot healthier a lot longer than if you just force it down using a medication. The other thing I've observed is that the medications often block the body's own sensitivity, their own insulin sensitivity. In other words, it makes it so that the body doesn't become insulin sensitive and healthy on its own. It doesn't heal. It just forces the situation. So when people are trying to use healthy approaches to diabetes, like dietary changes and whatnot, and they're still taking something like metformin, often their blood sugars won't respond until they go off the metformin. I'm not sure why that happens. And then a lot of doctors in the past have used drugs that are called sulfonylurea. So how do you say that word?
Sulfonylurea.
These are early diabetic medications that, in fact, destroy the beta cells. So some early people who were treated early with these drugs and bombarded with them now have less insulin production or becoming a type 1, moving toward type 1. So that you can also destroy the beta cells from this. The other reason for, incidentally, not letting your blood sugar stay high very long is you're also destroying your beta cells, and you want to preserve the beta cells so that you are healthy. Now, another thing that's really important to do with a diabetic in terms of a physical exam is a neuro exam and check for sensation in the feet and toes and reflexes of the limbs and eyes. These are all affected by high blood sugar. You get neuropathy in the feet. You can't feel the bottoms of the feet. The feet get cut. You get gangrene infections. Diabetics don't heal from infections well. They get more infections and they don't heal well, and that's how they lose their limbs. You have to get eye exams because the high blood sugars cause a whole array of eye problems. The retina and the lens have to be checked. Disconnected retinas. All that kind of stuff is very prevalent in diabetes and may be an early warning sign that diabetes is on its way. It could also be an early warning sign for multiple sclerosis, this retinitis. The examination of the feet, you also want to check for circulation in the extremity. Circulation is very poor in diabetics, another reason to control your blood sugars through diet. So what's the treatment? What Atkins has been telling us all along is that you have to count your carbohydrates. And you wouldn't, if you do this, you won't believe how many carbohydrates you're eating. What Bernstein says, and I've seen it work over and over and over again, is particularly in the morning when you get up and you have this dawn phenomenon where the body's been starving and it's starting to try to break down the tissues to make sugar, you don't miss breakfast. Do not miss breakfast. And really, your best breakfast is a high-protein breakfast. If you must have some carbohydrates, maybe 6 carbohydrates is enough. According to Bernstein, I've seen this work. 6 carbohydrates is about maybe half of a good size, medium-sized zucchini. Check your book on carbohydrate levels. You'll be really shocked at what is high and what's low. You'll be really surprised. And Bernstein suggests 12 grams of carbohydrates at your other meals, lunch and dinner. Atkins has his own approach. Now, you know, people are different. If you've been just recently diagnosed with diabetes, you may find that if you just shift to a diet where you use vegetables instead of starchy things like corn and potatoes and pasta and bread and blah, 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 certainly not sugar of any sort, of any kind, no dried fruit, no fruit. If you really go on a diet that controls for this, but you allow yourself to have a lot of vegetables and meat and lots of fat, good quality, natural, undamaged fat, butter, olive oil, unrefined, cold-pressed oils, organic meat, not range-fed industrial products, you know, really controlling for that, you may find that your blood sugars will drop like a rock and that you won't have to go any further than that, and that if you start exercising and mobilizing your energy pathways and strengthening them and strengthening your heart, you'll be fine. Most diabetics, however, are very overweight, and as you get older, your capacity to handle carbohydrates goes down anyway. So in my experience, you may get your blood sugars down into the normal levels, but if you don't get your weight down, you're not going to get better. Your insulin sensitivity is going to be higher and more effective if you're thinner and you have more muscle on your body. Another reason to exercise. So some people may find that they have to ease into this diet instead of going right on an Atkins induction diet. It depends on how sick you are and how fast this has to happen, how serious it is. Some people may find that doing something like the Atkins induction diet, which is a two-week period of doing 20 carbs per day, which is basically one salad and the rest of the time you're eating meat and fat, it's the first 2 weeks, it's not a diet forever like that. Then you start increasing your vegetable intake a little bit, maybe add a few tiny amounts of fruit, to see what happens with your blood sugars and your weight gain and stuff. At the point where you start seeing a change, then you go back down to where you don't see it, where it stabilizes. But some people are all-or-nothing people, and if they do an induction diet like the Atkins induction diet, what will happen is that you will get over your food addictions and everything rather fast, and even though you'll feel like hell maybe the first 2 weeks, getting used to it, lightheaded, lots of withdrawal symptoms from the fun foods, you may find that you will get used to it faster if you do it that way instead of doing it slowly. Either way that you do it, I mean, I traditionally have started people off just bagging the starches and eating vegetables as carbohydrates and bagging the fruit for a while and really loading them up with supplements. That has worked, and then eventually the carbohydrates have to come down in someone who has really been diabetic for a long time. But the weight has to come off. There's no two ways around this. If you are overweight and you're diabetic, you must lose weight. That's the only way to really make this work and to be better. Now, a question you may have to ask yourself is depression an issue here? Are you medicating yourself with food? And if that's the case, it's going to be very hard for you to go on and do this unless you deal with the depression also. And there may be dietary ways, you know, the fish oils which are used to treat depression sometimes don't work until people are taking 9,000 milligrams of fish oil a day. That's 9 gigantic capsules a day, 3 with each meal. Sometimes it takes a few days or a week to get used to them. You might repeat them, or you might have to start slow getting up to that level. But fish oils for diabetics, not flaxseed, because they won't convert. But the omega-3s will help with the depression. Probably needs to be a high dose. Do you need some counseling? Do you need some emotional support? I'm not suggesting you go on a psychiatric med that will make your weight go up. What I'm suggesting is, what is it that's holding you back? Is this an enormous addiction to starches? Are there food allergies involved? Do those have to be cleaned up? What do you need to do? What do you need in terms of support? Are you depressed? Let's deal with those things first, huh? Now, in terms of vitamins, antioxidants are very important here because you're creating a lot of free radicals in the body with high blood sugars. So all of, you know, the A, the C, the vitamin E also protects these fish oils when you're taking a lot of fish oils from turning rancid. Lipoic acid and CoQ10 mobilize the energy capacity in your cells, are very important for learning to burn fat as a fuel, very important for diabetics. The doses will vary according to the size of the person. Lipoic acid may be 250 to 600. You don't want to take too much lipoic acid if you're also taking thyroid medication, which is a whole other show. CoQ10 may be 30 to 33 times a day, 60 twice a day. milligrams. Circulation has to be addressed, so the mineral balance has to be robust. There has to be enough potassium. There has to be enough magnesium to counterbalance the hypertension. You don't want to go above 1,500 milligrams with calcium. You might do better with maybe 800 to 1,000 of calcium and maybe equal amounts of magnesium if you don't get diarrhea from that. Vitamin C, obviously important for circulation, at least 3,000 a day. There are many vitamins and supplements that are touted for diabetes. Some of them work, some of them do not, and some of them work in some people and don't in others. So the high doses of chromium, who knows? It couldn't hurt to take 1,000 to 2,000 mcgs of chromium, but chromium is a toxic metal. You don't want to overload yourself with that. Vanadium, very low in some individuals. Small amounts of it, you can try it, see how it works. Biotin. High doses of biotin, 5,000 mcgs, I think it is, has been shown to lower blood sugars. Chinese ginseng, Panax ginseng, not Siberian ginseng, not American ginseng, works for diabetics. Jimena silvestri works for some people, not everyone. But don't think that you can do this with supplements alone. The diet is absolutely the most important component of this, along with exercise. Now, exercise initially raises blood sugar because you're trying to make fuel for the body. But as you continue, in other words, you don't want to go out for 5 minutes and do something vigorous. You don't want to run for a bus. You want to run for 15 or 20 minutes or walk for at least 20 minutes to half an hour or more if you can do it. But don't not exercise because you don't have 20 minutes. Even 10 to 15 minutes after a meal will drop your blood sugars. Some people have to exercise more vigorously to drop their blood sugar. Some people find a moderate walk after a meal just incredible for lowering blood sugars. So exercise drops your blood sugar as you continue, not in the initial stages. The alpha cells in the pancreas release, remember, glucagon, when blood sugar is low, when you start exercising, the glucagon signals the muscles and liver to convert the stored sugar back into sugar for the blood sugar to go up, then it goes up, and then as your store of glucose are exhausted, the liver uses the protein, you know, the other thing. So in anaerobic exercise, when you're doing weightlifting, you're going to burn more sugar. In aerobic exercise, you will burn sugar until your body begins to burn fat, but you want to burn fat because you want to lose weight. So both types of exercise are important. It's very important to add muscle to your body if you're insulin resistant because muscle is active tissue. It burns fat as fuel even when you're resting, and it is insulin sensitive. So changing the composition of your body toward lean muscle mass will make you healthier. So both aerobic exercise where you're burning fat and you're walking for long periods, you're hiking, you're running, you're biking. Also remember that, you know, stress, if too much of it, the exercise phenomena of the blood sugar goes up is because the major muscles are fueled for a fight or flight, which is why stress raises blood sugar and causes you to burn your muscle tissues. So it's balance, balance, balance. You have to have enough rest. But you have to exercise both the anaerobic weightlifting stuff to increase muscle and not have, you know, I say this like you have to. You don't have to do any of this. What works best for treating diabetes in a non-pharmaceutical approach is to include both of these things in your life. And it doesn't have to be long, exhaustive sessions. These can be short sessions, 20-minute, 15-minute sessions will help just consistently. We're out of time. I want to really thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information or if you want a copy of the cassette, a cassette of this show, cassette copy, not a transcript, you can call my information number 24 hours a day. It's 707-874-2772, 874-2772. You can also go to the website for a list of other available shows. The website is www.yourownhealthandfitness.com, and is spelled out, yourownhealthandfitness.com. Next week, I'm going to be back with an interview with Dr. Stephen Eyer about using insulin potentiation therapy in conjunction with chemotherapy at very low doses to cure cancer without side effects. You can then use the insulin together. In other words, you're starving the cancer cells is what happens. But apparently, it is symptom-free. And it works. So we'll be talking about that next week. The engineer for your own health and fitness here at the Powerhouse Brewery in Sebastopol is George Curtis. Thanks to Johnny Otis in the Powerhouse and at KPFA, Lisa Ballard. I'm Lena Berman. Your own health and fitness is produced by Free Speech Radio. May it live forever, KPFA FM 94.1, Berkeley, California. I'll be back with you next week.